Well, let me add my welcome to Tom. It's really good to see you here this lunchtime. And thanks so much. I mean, this is probably the hottest day we're going to have now until Christmas. So thank you for braving the ridiculous heat outside and coming to join us this lunchtime. Welcome, too, if you're joining us online. We carry on in our series in Daniel, Living in the Lion's Den. And we're dipping into this ancient book and to ask the question, what does it have to teach us today as we consider what it means to be one of God's people, a Christian, here today. Now, in Daniel chapter 3, that little bit we've just heard read out, God's people are so convinced that their God is powerful and just and good that they're prepared to stand against the flow of where everybody else is going and to do what is right in the Lord's eyes. To stand, in this case, very directly and personally against a tyrannical leader, King Nebuchadnezzar, and instead to stand for God. Now, it's particularly intense in this example because, of course, their lives are at stake. The big point, I've tried to capture it there. You'll find this handout hopefully useful just to guide us through our time. You'll see the introduction there. I've said to sin or to suffer. Essentially, serving God faithfully never requires God's people to make a sinful decision. But to serve God faithfully will often be the less attractive, the less trodden path. And so it will potentially open up a path of difficulty or suffering or setback. And that's why I've put it like that, to sin or to suffer. I think we're very good as human beings, aren't we, at sort of finding, trying to find sort of compromise, being tempted just to sort of, you know, a little sin with our fingers crossed. You know, surely the Lord won't mind, it's what everybody else is doing. And the big point here is God never requires us to sin, even in a small way, to be faithful to him. Now, during preparation, I read about, there are lots of examples through history which really bring this to bear. This was one that really stood out, and I think captures the tone of what we're talking about in Daniel 3 really well. It's a more recent example. It happened back in June 1950. So what's that, about 75 years ago? This is the Korean War. True story. Now, the communist forces from North Korea, supported by China, Soviet Union, they invaded South Korea. And as they went sort of, as they sort of progressed south, they decided to particularly target Christian communities. They came across one particular Korean village, and the occupying forces found a young Christian man, and they thought he would be just the right person to make a public example of. And so they gathered together everybody into the town square. As I was reading the bit of history, I mean, it sort of had lots of Hunger Game sort of vibes to it. But again, as I said, this is a true story. And everyone gathered in the village, and this young Christian man was placed right in the center of the town square. And one of the communist soldiers held a pistol to his head and said very simply, "Denounce Jesus Christ and embrace communism or die." Now, the story goes that the man understandably hesitated, looked terrified, but then apparently looked around and saw lots of the faces that he knew, including some that he had led to Christian faith. And then apparently he raised his gaze to heaven and said these words, "I believe in Jesus Christ." And the shot was fired. The young man was executed. Now, that's a particularly intense situation, but that's capturing the tone of Daniel chapter 3. That's what we're dealing with here. No compromise. Daniel chapter 3 goes right in at the deep end. We'll look at the story in a little bit more detail, and you'll see the first point there. Prepared to suffer rather than to sin. Now, our three friends that we've been following in this chapter, we started last week, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Well, they make this clear with their statement back to the king. You remember what the king had just said? The king had said, "You must bow down to my image," dealing with them personally. "You must bow down or you'll be thrown into the fire." Look at their answer, verse 16. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter." In other words, what they say to the king directly is, "We don't actually even need time to think about our decision." It was a very clear act of defiance. It didn't need to be deliberated over. They knew where they stood. And again, I mean, just try to put yourself in that situation. We can tone it down a little bit. Your life's not on the line, but there's something you've been asked to do by your boss, by your line manager, and you're not comfortable with it. You know it isn't quite right. Think of all the things that fly through your mind, you know. But everyone else is doing it. But the office demands it. But I'll lose my job if I don't do what they're asking. It won't be honoring to my parents if I lose my job. Anyway, as we made a big point last week, the three friends, they know deep down that serving God never requires a sinful decision. And so they answer essentially, "No, King, we know where we stand." You can almost imagine them, the three friends, shaking their heads as they speak to the king directly. Look at verse 17 of chapter 3. "If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Now, in their mind, King Nebuchadnezzar has never been in charge. I mean, he may be the king. He's a tyrannical king. He may be the king, but he's not their God. He's not their king. He's not the God that has a track record. I mean, you think about God's people at this stage in salvation history, and they would have looked back to one of the most amazing events of the Old Testament. We talk about it as the Exodus, where God delivered probably about 2.5 million people in captivity in Egypt out into the promised land. They knew their God had a track record of saving. And so in the end, they knew that they could stand with their God. And that's a helpful sort of point of application for us. You see, our faith rests on God's proven track record. Look at what he's done in rescuing his people. For us, we see that in the cross. He has done everything, hasn't he? By sending Jesus to die and to take away the worst that can happen. And so we never need to go through the sort of the process of moral or ethical gymnastics, thinking, well, if I stand in this way and cross my fingers, then I can probably agree to doing what my boss has asked me to do, even though I know it's wrong. We never need to do that. Notice, though, it's quite interesting, even through this act of defiance, they remain respectful. They address the king appropriately. They use his name. They repeatedly use his title. They put into practice the old adage we sometimes talk about. They disagree without being disagreeable. In summary, in the end, they clearly have a mature and correct understanding of God. They have a right fear of the Lord. That expression isn't used in the text, but that's very clearly what underpins this, a right fear of the Lord. It was John Calvin who famously said, "There is nothing more powerful to overcome temptation than fear of God." In the end, having a right and godly and reverent fear of the God who made us will be what we need to make sensible decisions in the here and now. And as New Testament believers, of course, we have real clarity on that. Think about some of the things that happened in the New Testament. Think about Peter and the apostles. So this is just after the cross and resurrection and ascension. Peter and the apostles, they're preaching publicly in Jerusalem about the Lord Jesus. And the authorities, they come and tell them off. They come and tell them to stop proclaiming clearly about Jesus. And then Peter famously says, as he stands before what would have been a quite scary situation in front of all the authorities, he said to them, "We must obey God rather than men." Now, of course, such acts of defiance or civil disobedience, they carry consequences. For Peter and the apostles, well, they were flogged. It immediately led to a reaction of being publicly flogged and then being told again to not speak. That would have been a very sort of painful, hard thing to endure. And of course, as they carried on speaking, which is what they did straight away, they carried on risking that whole thing being repeated or worse. And certainly, as you consider our three friends, as they stand before Nebuchadnezzar, who probably should be described as a psychopath, I mean, look at them. This brings us to the second point. The suffering does look especially nasty, doesn't it? Have a look at verse 19. Nebuchadnezzar, when he heard their act of defiance, I mean, Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury. The expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and he ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated. Do you see how deeply personal this becomes? Expression of face changed against them. You see, the king was not reasonable. His sort of contorted face suggests distorted behavior. And so the superheated furnace, 7 times hotter than normal. I don't even think that's possible, is it? I mean, how do you get a furnace 7 times what it normally is? The idea is it's just a ridiculously hot punishment. We're meant to feel, though, the personal nature of this attack. Athanasius was the bishop of Alexandria. Go back in time now to the mid-300s, so 300 years after Jesus, more or less. And at the time, there was a very, very popular heretic who was doing the rounds. He was known as Arius. The heresy that he was in charge of propagating, which is still alive and kicking today, the Arian teaching denies the deity of Christ. So the modern day sort of followers on from Arius would be the Jehovah's Witnesses today. Anyway, Athanasius, the Bishop of Alexandria, he publicly opposed Arius, even though all of the churches were increasingly embracing Arius's teaching. As a result, this faithful good bishop was exiled 5 times, 5 different occasions for his opposition. And in the end, there was a public sort of hearing where Athanasius had to stand before the emperor. And the emperor demanded that he stop having a go at Arius and publicly accepted his teaching. And the emperor used these words to reason with Athanasius. He says, "Do you not realize, Athanasius, that the whole world is against you?" There was a period of silence, and then apparently Athanasius answered, "Emperor, then I am against all the world." The whole weight of the world. That's what it must have felt like for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego as they stood before this psychopathic king who said he was going to chuck them in the furnace. Now, there is some relief for us as readers at this point. If you were with us last week, do you remember I drew our attention to some pantomime-type elements in the first half of chapter 3? It's not without its continuance. There's a little bit of a plot twist here. Here is Nebuchadnezzar trying to punish God's men, but look who are the only people that end up getting punished or who end up dying at this stage. The only people who die are his own. As they even get close to the furnace, it immediately kills them. And certainly, I think that functions for us as readers to sort of relieve the pressure a little bit. Perhaps it sent a little bit of a message as well to our 3 friends as they face this really scary trial going into the fiery furnace, to see that there was a little bit of divine justice going on at this stage. Anyway, the inevitable happens. End of verse 23, the 3 men get chucked into the burning fiery furnace. Now, I think even if you'd never read beyond this point in your life, you'd be pretty confident that the unexpected was about to happen. You see, the flow of the story has sort of set that up. Anyway, we can see, as we know the end of the story, we know that they survive. And there is, therefore, a sort of an unpredictable irony. Isn't it amazing? I mean, as these 3 men stood in front of this psychopathic king, they were actually safer in the burning furnace than they were in front of the king, which is somewhat ironic, isn't it? And that brings us to the last point there. The Lord remained with them through it all. We rejoin the story in verse 24. King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, and he rose up in haste. "Did we not cast 3 men bound into the fire?" They answered and said, "True, O king." He answered and said, "But I see 4 men unbound walking in the midst of the fire. They're not hurt, and the appearance of the 4th is like a son of the gods." Now, these supernatural events do not leave Nebuchadnezzar unchanged. We're told that he was astonished. Quite literally, he was left bewildered, perhaps even fearful of what he was witnessing. The 4th man, I mean, what a bizarre thing. A 4th man walking around in the fire. An angel, possibly. The pre-incarnate Jesus Christ, perhaps. It doesn't really matter. The point is, clearly, a theophany, an appearance of God in some form or other, comfort for our three friends, assurance that they've done the right thing. And that's always true. I mean, the Lord doesn't promise to protect or shield us from the hardships in this world, but he does promise to be with us wherever we go. How wonderfully portrayed it is there. And sometimes, of course, it's only as we enter these trials that we're aware of the Lord's sustaining, powerful presence throughout. I mean, life can be, you know, we all want the easy life, we want success, and we want everything to go well, but it's easy just to sort of take our mind off what's actually important when things are going well. And sometimes the Lord will use these difficulties and trials to make us aware of his presence. I remember a situation not so long ago. Some friends had been through a real difficulty. Christian couple, they had a couple of boys, and one of them was diagnosed with cancer at quite a young age. Now, they went through a really, really hard time because it looked pretty certain that this young chap was going to not make it. And that was really hard for them, understandably. As time progressed, the situation changed, and in the end, this young chap did make it through and was in the end given the all clear, and that was all wonderful. But interestingly, I then did a little bit of a public interview with them, and I asked them if they could explain the experience they had. And I said to the mum who'd gone through all of this, I mean, I can see now that your son is okay and got the all clear. That's wonderful that, you know, everything's all right. But it must have been terrible. It must be something that you wish had never happened. And she said, not at all. I wrote down what she said. She said, that's not the case. Every moment was a privilege. The Lord sustained us, and I wouldn't change any of the experience, even if I could. Now, that really surprised me. Even when things looked absolutely dire, she was deeply aware of the Lord's sustaining presence. Charles Spurgeon, a famous London preacher of a bygone era, he said this on this passage. He said, you must go into the furnace if you would have the nearest and dearest dealings with Christ. You see, when the moment to stand comes, when the boss asks you that unreasonable thing, at that moment, well, we know that the Lord will be with us as we choose to do the right things, even if the consequences are tough. Unpleasant, they'll be worth it. I had a friend who was working in the city not so long ago. He hadn't been in his job very long, and he was encouraged to secure extra business. He was asked particularly, he was a Christian, and he was asked by his boss to say things to some of his potential clients which weren't true. And the boss explained, look, it's not really true, but it works really well to secure a little bit of extra business. And then the boss used this bit of line of reasoning. As my friend objected and said that didn't sound like the right thing to do, the boss said, you shouldn't be somebody that works against the integrity of the team. This is what we do. Now, my Christian friend decided that that wasn't right, and he made a stand. He lost his job. And it didn't lead to the easiest of times. It's not an instant sort of happy end that he immediately got a promotion or anything like that. Nothing like that. He had a hard time. There were periods of uncertainty. He hadn't been married very long. It wasn't the best time to lose a job. But I know now that he looks back, not a moment of regret, because of the Lord sustaining through it all. We know, too, from elsewhere, that God will never leave us in the furnace for longer than we can bear. As somebody else wrote, the Lord will always keep his eye on the clock and his hand on the thermostat. He knows how long and he knows how much. Well, as we begin to draw threads, look at how our story is resolved. Look at verse 26. Nebuchadnezzar came near and declared, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out, come here. And they came out of the fire. And that brings us to the conclusion. You see, the Lord will always deliver his people in the end. And there are some wonderful little details here. Look at verse 27. Again, you've got this rather strange entourage of all the important people are gathered, the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the king's counselors, they gathered together. And they saw that the fire had not had any power over the bodies of those men. The hair of their heads was not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, no smell of fire had come upon them. You see, the deliverance, this is the most important bit. the deliverance was so much more impressive this way. Sure, the Lord could have saved them from the fire, but instead he saved them through the fire. And to really rub home the point, remember that same fire had totally annihilated the king's men, you know, the guards. They got killed straight away. And now we're told on our three friends, not even a trace of fiery smell on their clothes. That's how much the Lord protected them. Well, as God's people today, living this side of the cross, I mean, we stand in a situation now of complete deliverance because of what Jesus did. I mean, I mentioned it already earlier on. The worst that can ever happen to any human being is to face God unforgiven. To have turned your back on God, to have not accepted his free pass through Jesus Christ and his death. Jesus took God's punishment. Jesus took the worst, if you want to sort of portray that as a fiery furnace, the worst imaginable punishment. Jesus took it. And what that means is that we can face, well, sometimes bad things, but they'll always only be relatively bad compared to the worst that can happen. And we can face them with confidence, knowing that the worst that can happen to us has been dealt with by Jesus. I was talking to Tom Wright, the system minister here, about this, and he was saying that the reformers really struggled. He's been doing a bit of reading around history, as he often does. And he was telling me that the reformers really struggled with the idea, lots of them faced being burnt at the stake. And obviously, that was a terrifying thing to face. One of the ways that they coped with that, because many of them did go through that, was to devote that time to real prayer, even as the flames began to overwhelm them. You see, we can face trials, even if we suffer. The Lord never requires us to choose sin over suffering. So that's where we end. But just as we end, I mean, what a wonderful conclusion. I wonder if you noticed the very final verse, verse 30. The king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Who would have guessed that? Every one of us would have predicted that if with an act of public defiance, where you go against the boss. But that's the sort of God that we believe in, a God that will bring about good in the end. And they're a picture, ultimately, of the final deliverance. Human reason would have suggested compromise, then promotion, God's way. Defiance, faithfulness, deliverance, promotion. Well, we need to close there. I'm going to hand back to Tom to close our meeting. Thank you.